Community-based respite is just that. It's a broad set of services, different community by community. Most of the common ones that you think of are adult daycare places where for, we call it respite, but it's more than that. For an older adult, that's actually very therapeutic and safe and wise. But in many cases, they were built as a means of respite for a family member to be able to go off to work or to get their own shopping done, to take care of their own things. But adult day is probably the foremost underpinning of that. But it can be more than that. Community-based respite services can be centers where you can go for lifelong learning and other kinds of things. It's a very open model set of services based in the community to allow older adults to be able to, in most cases, continue to use their home as the primary hub of their life. And for periods of time, either have services coming into them, but in most cases, them going out for those services. Assisted living facilities are actually licensed facilities. And assisted living is actually not a term, a legal term, other than tangentially, in the state of Ohio. We call them residential care facilities. They provide assisted living. Assisted living is, if you actually think about it, it's a set of functions. It's helping somebody with something. I could do that in their home. I could do that in a place that they come to. But we talk about assisted living facilities, residential care facilities. The vast majority of those are, in fact, in the state of Ohio at least, are privately paid entities. There's an emerging amount of public payment for assisted living out west of us, and it'll undoubtedly move its way east. But right now, there is a Medicaid, which going to the heart of Cindy's point, you know, one of those payer sources. There is a small number of assisted living facilities that can use you can use Medicaid as the payment source. But for the most part, these are privately paid places. Some tend to be as expensive as nursing homes because, in some cases, they provide some of the same services as nursing homes. But they are regulated. They're regulated at a different kind of level. There's a limitation on the amount of care that can be received. There were some pretty strict laws about how many days of services, lots of fights over people self-managing their medications versus being able to be given their medications, and so on and so forth. A lot of dynamics around, particularly including, incidentally, from the nursing lobby, my sisters, in terms of being able to make sure that we weren't allowing these facilities to just become other nursing homes. Well, some of that was won, some of that was lost, doesn't really matter. The key is that there's a large amount of overlap, but there are some parameters and limitations on what the assisted living facility can do. Probably the foremost of those really comes from the core issue of who they are. An assisted living facility runs on the dynamic of negotiated risk. In other words, you know that there's the possibility that mom will fall down. You know that we're trying to allow her to do as many things for herself as possible, that we're going to bring services in as needed, and we might be slightly behind the curve on that. A nursing home, on the other hand, not only says, I will make sure this person stays protected and safe, I also have the legal right to, in some cases, do things that are coercive in order to be able to do that, as long as I have your permission to do that and a medical order to do so. Different model. Different model. If you mix up the two, you end up with families very upset when they found out that mom fell down because she was trying to sit down in somebody's wheelchair and the wheels spun out beneath it. Conversely, you find out a situation where you say, well, we can't tie your mom down. We're not allowed to do that, and why would you want to? So it's important that we start to understand the distinctions that the nursing homes, much more regulated environments, much more structured environments, that's part of the reason they look the way that they do. They look a lot more like medical facilities in most cases. Some have done a great job with the architecture to try to soften that up a bit, but most assisted living facilities look far more home-like in that regard. Okay. The first thing you'll notice is the overlap and the redundancy in this continuum. Okay? In other words, as I said to you before, assisted living facilities, residential care facilities, can do a lot of stuff that the nursing homes can do. But many people who would have been living in a nursing home 10 years ago, 15 years ago, are now living perfectly fine in an assisted living facility. But 10, 15 years ago, they would have been in a nursing care facility because of the amount of assistance with activities of daily living. Likewise, all the way back to the level of the NORC, or the independent living, we find out that there are folks who can be kept in a much more autonomous, much more independent environment by providing those services in that we once referred to as assisted living and needed to be in a space of its own. So it's a very, very fluid environment in that regard. Some of the places where that gets confused, let me give an example. Medicare, we'll go back to this in a second to address Cindy's question. Medicare, the health insurance for older adults, does not generally pay for chronic long-term care. In other words, if you're healed up, you're fixed, you've done the best that we can get, you finished your time in the hospital, you've rehabbed, you now need somebody to assist you with that bathing, dressing, toileting, make sure that you're supervised. Medicare does not pay for that. It's health insurance, medical insurance, like your health insurance or your medical insurance. It's not disability insurance, okay? So then we get a little bit confused when we see, well, wait a second, these people are at the nursing home and they're all just getting assistance with their bathing and dressing and toileting and feeding and the like. And then these people are also getting those services, but Medicare is paying for it. And that's because, oh, you mean twice a day they're going down to the physical therapist, or the speech therapist is coming up to them, visit them in their room. And for that reason, Medicare is paying for it, yes. As odd as that sounds to somebody from outside of the system, and as mundane as it sounds for those of us who are in the system, it is kind of weird. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But the idea is we're also using those spaces, skilled nursing facilities. Skilled means two things. It's not just, oh, gee, that's what the nurse can do, which often comes down to, is there a tube sticking into you anyplace? Or are you receiving a therapy? But it also is a term of health finance. Skilled means Medicare is going to pay for it. So these folks are coming out of the hospital and they're going to rehab. And they're going to rehab under the same roof as other people who ain't rehabbing anymore. They just need this care. Different payer sources. Medicare is not about the place where you receive the care. Could be at home, could be at the skilled nursing. Medicare is about, are you getting better? Were you sick and are you rehabbing? Are you being restored back to something? Once you're restored, which may not be to the place that you wanted to be, but it's as far as we know how to take you, and the doctors and the physical therapists and the occupational therapists said, you've, hate to use this term, plateaued. You're it. We've maxed out what we can do for you right now. Or frankly, we've maxed out the number of days that we had available to try to do more for you right now. That's it. Now you go to a private pay situation, or we find another third-party payer. Cindy, yes, I will address that. But the key here is to remember the overlap in the services. So there are folks living out in their apartments who can get some of these same services by bringing them in as other people who then go and drop down $3,000, $3,500, $4,000 a month to purchase those by living someplace else. And so the key here is not to think dichotomously about this. Really allow to say, okay, what do I need to get done now and in the near future? What are all the possible options that make sense for us? If there's a house that is a perfectly good place, and I don't mind, frankly, turning this home into an assisted living facility, if I have the ability for somebody to always be there to open up the door to let the staff come in, then maybe that home is a perfectly legitimate place. If I don't have those things, if for reasons of the other spouse's privacy, if for reasons of the security and safety of the neighborhood, if for reasons of there ain't nobody around to stay there during the night when no staff is coming, then maybe having to move the person to the care makes more sense than the care to the person. And it's going to be different, not just on the basis of the clinical characteristics of the human being who's receiving these services, it's going to be different on the basis of the context of that family and that space. You with me? It's customized per person because the continuum, I'm telling you right now, when you talk to somebody from an assisted living facility, they will tell you about assisted living facilities and all the wonderful good advantages that come with that. But they will present to you as though it is a product. You talk to somebody from the nursing home, likewise, the exact same thing. God bless them all. You talk to my colleagues over at the Area Agency on Aging, which in our system, those are the folks through which all the public funds for aging funnel. And they are, God bless those people, they're zealots for home care. They want older adults to live in our community like normal people do. It's not like they're anti-nursing home, but they know the moats that have been built around a lot of our nursing homes, figuratively. They want people in neighborhoods. They want old folks to see little kids. They want these are good social workers. This is what they care about, and God bless them for it. But there also needs to be the recognition that it's got to fit the right context, and that in our zealotry to make sure that we're having this perfect picture that we'd like to see, that it fits for this particular person. The services can be morphed. I'm telling you that right now. You can adjust the system to be able to find what you need. The key is going to be understanding the context, not of the clinical presentation. There are some really, really sick people living in their homes right now. And there are some really less sick people living in assisted living facilities right now. So are we clear about that? This is not principally driven by, oh, you have this many ADLs and this many IADLs, you must need to be here. No, it's not true. What's true is I can build a care system out of just about anything. The key is going to be, what do I have to work with? What are the resources I have to work with? And the resources are, yes, money, family, and physical space. Give me the right combination of those things. If all of a sudden I've got family members who want to have a house with an in-law suite, you'd be amazed at the creativity that we can have to be able to put together something that works for all members of this family and, frankly, could end up being a blessing to the next generations of that same family. We'll talk about that in a little bit. The key, the first problem, in the same way I said, we got to walk out of this box thinking like Christians, okay? Now I want you to think like a planner. This is not the purchase of separate products. This is the creation of a plan. And we will take the bits and pieces together and we'll wrap them into something that, as closely as we can approximate it, makes sense for this mom, this dad, in this context, in this neighborhood, with this family. And the first thing we have to get past is any judgments about, oh, I wish we had something else to work with. If only my brother would, dot, dot, dot. Get past it. Let's shake the boy around a little bit, see what he's in for. Everybody empty their pockets, put it on the table, say, this is what figuratively I have to offer. This is my time, this is my money, this is my skill set that I have that I can offer to this care situation within this family. Now look at that table and pull back anything that you really shouldn't have put on in the first place. Let's quit talking pie in the sky here. You've got kids to raise, you've got a career of your own, you've got other things. As a planner, I'm looking for give me something real. Because chances are we can find whatever we need out of this continuum of services, not by treating it as a separate silos and buying the right thing, but by looking to see where's the best place for now and in the immediate future that we can put together that set of services. Okay? The financial payment source, Cindy, to your point, makes a huge difference in terms of that continuum of care. By and large, as I said to you before, already this morning I've had two instances where folks caught themselves on the last four letters. Medicare, Medicaid. Why they ever came up with the names for these things, always having that same first four letters, when the last four were going to change everything else in the rest of the sentence, I have no idea. But that's what we live with. Medicare, as you'll recall, I've said a couple of times before, is in fact the health insurance, pays for the medical insurance for older adults, blind and disabled people. Okay? We're good on that? The Medicaid is a public assistance program for folks who are impoverished, indigent. Now, whether they began indigent and spent all their money on their care, whether they began indigent and did some planning that they, or whether they started with resources and became indigent by spending on their care, that's one possibility. They started with resources and they transferred, moved those assets to somebody else, and now they seem to be indigent. That's another option. There's any number of different reasons, but the bottom line is, if you meet the eligibility as being poor and sick, then Medicaid comes into play. Medicaid, like Medicare, is a principally federally funded program, but it, unlike Medicare, it's not nationally organized with that element of portability. It's state by state. In fact, it's administrated county by county. So for instance, those of you, go ahead.
Medicaid is by state?
Yeah. Medicaid was originally designed back in the Great Society period, was originally designed as being half state, half federal. That would be 50-50. What ended up happening is, just a little bit of political history for those of you who kind of find this interesting and wonky, as I do, is that, you know, over time, as benefits increased, The federal government came in with their dollars, and you can't have an unfunded mandate. So they couldn't dictate to the states, you have to kick in yours as well because we did ours. So, you know, we fought a civil war over some of those issues at one time, if you'll recall. And so the states said, no, 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 we have sovereign control over the organization of healthcare. Why? Well, because the Constitution didn't give it to you. Now we're looking at that a little differently right now. And so this will be very, very interesting how this all goes down. But the Supreme Court has basically recently reaffirmed that, yes, at least in terms of the health services themselves, not the commerce thereof, healthcare is supposed to be at the state level. What ended up happening bit by bit was that the feds pay more money into Medicaid, but it's still organized at the state level. So if you go to Pennsylvania versus Ohio versus Michigan versus Indiana, you have different rules. The base structure is the same. Some of the rules are the same. But for instance, how poor you need to be, how much money you can keep per month is different state by state. It's an interesting piece, and it's fun for a conversation sometime to talk about sort of the political science and the economics of that. For here, now, the key is I'll talk about Ohio, because I'm guessing that's where we're based here, okay? Though some might be over across into the Pennsylvania border. But in either case, there's a set of rules within the Ohio Administrative Code, not the Ohio Revised Code, the Ohio Administrative Code, sort of the wonky stuff inside, that outlines who is eligible, how it's supposed to be managed, and it's actually administered at a state, at a county by county level. So for instance, I might some days be helping families and I'll be up at 17th Street in Payne in Cleveland, in downtown, but also could be in Painesville at that pretty courthouse building, could be, Portage County is really lovely, their offices. That for those of you who didn't pick that up, that was a little sarcastic. In any case, it's a human services department, right? So you can get the idea. This is the place that folks go for Medicaid for non-older adults. Though a disproportionate amount of it is spent on older adults. It's 55% right now, 55 to 60% of Medicaid is spent on older adults, principally those living in nursing facilities. The rest is for all those moms that, you know, have Healthy Start for their kids, WIC programs, so on and so forth. And so, but it's all a part of the safety net of services for folks to be able to get what they need. So in this case, you're poor, you're sick, you're disabled, Medicaid would be a place that you can go. Great question. Perfect. Okay. And we are going to, there was a reason I could give Cindy that assurance. We're going to go through each of those payer sources. Okay. But I'll address it here because I saw the Medicare versus Medicaid piece. Okay. Medicare is medical insurance for older adults, blind, and disabled. Yes, that actually is true. The question just for the recording. Is there a penalty for signing up late into Medicare? Medicare has its own strategy as well. You're eligible for it at 65 unless you're blind, disabled first, or 2 years after you gain disability, you automatically get into Medicare if you want to. But yes, some people choose. They continue with their employer. They stay on their employer's plan. And that needs to be coordinated so as to avoid penalties and things like that. But Medicare is medical insurance. It pays for hospitals. That's part A. It pays for doctors. Part B, therapies. Part B, it has a deductible that goes with it for the hospitals, and it has a copay that goes with it for each and one of those doctor's visits, and that's why you'll see people have those Medicare supplement policies, an accompanying piece of insurance that they purchase. You mentioned the AARP, United Healthcare product is one, but all of the major insurers have Medicare, many of them, have Medicare products that they sell that accompany to pay for that copay and deductible, okay? But that's Medicare. Medicaid is for indigent situations. That's a part of the safety net, okay? And the point being here that financial driver changes some of the options that are available to folks, depending upon where you live. Now, even that, just as I'm saying before, we can usually morph things. We can kind of combine the services to meet the need not always if the case where we're talking about is the financial payer source itself, okay? Because for instance, Medicaid pays just about universally for nursing care. If you're a nurse in a nursing home, Medicaid is actually the primary payer for folks that are in nursing homes right now. That's in part because some folks used up all of their own resources and they're still there in the nursing homes. But in any case, Medicaid is a major player in terms of paying for long-term care in a nursing home setting. It's a very minor player in assisted living facilities. There's a few that have decided, it's called the waiver program. Kind of seems funny to me that you have to get a waiver to get the less expensive, more desirable services. So home care is a waiver. Assisted living is a waiver. Even those are the things people are screaming for that they'd rather have. They don't really, really want to go to nursing homes in most cases. But nursing homes fully paid for. You got to get a waiver to do the other ones. It seems a little bit ironic. But in any case, welcome to the brave new world of health finance. The bottom line is very minimal amount. Handful in Lake County, handful, generally very rural areas, very urban areas, will tend to have more of the assisted living facilities, residential care facilities, that say, yeah, we're willing to participate in Medicaid. Why? Well, because Medicaid's not a particularly great payer for them. If they can instead sell that bed, that unit, to someone private pay, they might be willing to leave it empty for a while in the hopes of the next person coming along. If they're pretty convinced, ain't nobody coming, then maybe I'll participate in this. But there's another case. There's a handful of places, particularly some of the really high-end, often nonprofits, that participate in it. Part of that is to be able to say back to the Area Agency on Aging, we're good neighbors. You know, we're part of this too. We see the need, we want to participate in it, so we're going to keep a selected number of beds. But as importantly, often more importantly, they can put a stipulation, because as you see here, the regulations are different. If I'm on Medicaid and there's an empty bed at that nursing home, I can walk into that. If there's nobody on a waiting list waiting ahead of me on this, and it was a fully credentialed, documented waiting list, that available bed is available to me even though I'm the lowest payer in your house. I'm coming in with my Medicaid, I am allowed. You can't kick me out. You can't tell me I can't have that. You can't hold it for somebody who will pay you more privately. Otherwise, you are putting in risk, in threat, all of your Medicaid payments for everybody in this place. You'd never, of course, do that at a nursing home. So nursing home, it's much more structured and much more regulated, not just at the level of the provision of care, but even on how people can get that care in the first place within the Medicaid system. When they do the waiver programs, it's a little looser. Waiver had a lot more elbow room for what are the rules going to be. So one of the things that we find is that many of those even high-end care facilities where people pay a front-end entrance fee to get in, the continuous care retirement communities, some of them are participating in the Medicaid waiver program for assisted living. Now, why would they do that? Well, I mean, they want to be good neighbors. I do get that. But just from a pure economic standpoint, they also place a stipulation that says you need to be a current resident. Well, you couldn't have been a current resident at this place if you didn't make through our vetting in the first place to be able to be accepted under the private basis. So we already know pretty much what your assets are. So why are we doing that? Well, we're keeping it for if we're wrong, if you spent up all of your money, you've been here, you know, Mrs. Methuselah, it's been lovely having you here, you know, since we opened this place up. And decades later, you're still here and you're running out of your money. At least then we can go to this third party payer and they'll give us something for your care in it. But we're not going to kick you out, little 90-year-old lady who's been receiving these services. Okay? So it is fluid even, Cindy, to your point, it's even fluid on the finance side. You just got to kind of understand the rules, and that guides out where it moves from there. Hang on a second. Okay. Very, very quickly. I know this was the part I warned you. Some of this was taking a sip of water out of a fire hydrant. Okay. All right. I'm going to dance through some of the statistics because you really don't need it except to this particular point. Okay? The reason I left these blank, what percentage of older adults will need long-term care in their lifetime, what percentage of seniors will use a nursing home, what percentage of seniors using a nursing home will use it for 5 years, 5+ years. Why did I put those out? Okay? And more importantly, why did I leave them blank? Any of you that have ever had a conversation with a long-term care insurance agent, and to be clear, I am licensed to do long-term care insurance. I do some of my consulting, looking at other people's botched products. Excuse me, looking at making sure that we're clear about the parameters of things that people have purchased or are purchasing. Okay, in my own practice, is around long-term care insurance. And actually, I think for the right person in the right way, it could be a really cool thing to have. Okay, and I'll address it very, very briefly in our last section. But the reason I leave these blank is because depending upon how I fill them in, all with a truthful statement of fact, it can present to you a completely different picture about your perceived level of risk. And anyone that uses statistics within marketing knows that is a skill set that you do. You're telling the truth. You're just making sure that you're placing it in a context so as to most strongly support your argument. So I won't question the morality of that necessarily, but you are telling an actual factual piece of information. The truth of the matter is, now I'll give, I'm in generals, not numbers, and I can fill in the numbers for you later if you want. Yeah, the majority of us will spend some time, the significant minority of us will spend some period of time of our lives receiving formal, institutional long-term care services. The majority of us will receive it like most people are receiving it right now, which will come from family, friends, within a home environment. Okay? So the likelihood of you going to a nursing home for 5+ years, I can give you that statistic. It's about 10%. Here's the challenge in both cases. If you look at it from the perspective of a population, you look at a perspective from this room, 10% isn't all that great a risk, right? I mean, what's the chance that I'm in the 90% versus the chance that I'm in the 10%? Well, I mean, there's 99 times 10, so, right? Here's the difficulty. No, for you, you're either in or you're out. It's binary. Flip a coin. I don't know for you. That's the nature of statistics, right? It tells me a lot about the population. It doesn't tell me a whole lot about the individual's risk. There are a handful of things I can do to kind of grasp my way more toward it. But what's very, very important when we're talking about all of this is that we recognize how context-laden this is. To use massive numbers, and I don't care if you use them just for Cuyahoga County or just for Lake County, you use them for the whole country, you use the fact that the Swedes have data about all kinds of stuff. You can use the whole worldwide information. It doesn't make a whole lot of difference when it comes down to asking the question, yes, but will I need it? I don't know whether you are in that 10%. If you are, that's a massive amount of money and resources that are going to be needed. Or if you're in the very large number of people who won't spend more than $25,000 in their entire lifetime on any of these services. In fact, a significant number of people, 15-20%, who never spend a dime on this. So what are the risk factors? Very, very quickly, of course we're looking at clinical phenomena. Using time as wisely as I can right now, I'm going to give you a really, really quick and dirty that I would probably get thrown off of any nursing faculty for using, and now it's being recorded. But here's the deal. Think neck up, neck down. In general, and this is in no way to minimize the challenges of disability that come from osteo or rheumatoid arthritis, the challenges that come from chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. Oh, I mean, your heart breaks to see somebody's world getting smaller and smaller to the tether of an oxygen tank, okay? I mean, these are very, very real disabilities. But in general, neurological disease or the neurological effects of cardiovascular disease are the big risks. Progressive dementia, chronic neurological conditions like movement disorders, like Parkinson's disease, things like that. You get it. Why? What's the nature of the clinical? Here's as simple as it is. Why would it be neck up, neck down? That maybe I'll take it to one level deeper for your thinking. Think high morbidity, right? So any of you there know this literature, being sick more, more disability, high morbidity, low mortality. It didn't kill you. So a person that has a stroke, okay, something prompted, generally there were a bunch of risk factors. In some cases they knew about them, in some cases they didn't know about them, that caused that stroke. The stroke is what causes the disability. The stroke is why we need the home care. The stroke is why we need the assisted living facility or the nursing home, and depending upon how massive the amount of damage that is to that stroke, okay? Could be just an inability to be able to function, manage finances, very focal kind of problem, or it could be the loss of a side of a body, okay? In either case, whatever the effect of that stroke is, highest risk factor for a stroke is a previous stroke. Whatever those risk factors were, even now attended to and vigilant, more likely than not, you just got some bad blood vessels. And so you can imagine, in some cases, the mortality also gets collapsed a little bit as well. Why would cancer, for instance, not be high on the list? Because generally, in our society, particularly in a place like Cleveland, Ohio, you either get cured or you leave us relatively quickly by standards of long-term care. And so it's important to remember neck up, neck down. That's our big issues that we're concerned about in terms of risk factors, and most of which you can't do a thing about. Right now, there are no, other than some very researchy-oriented kinds of things, there's no real way of biologically being able to determine, except in a few variants of very early onset Alzheimer's disease, that we're able to do any kind of genetic testing, blood work, to be able to determine your risk factors on it. That will change, undoubtedly, as you know, who thought that the human genome was going to get mapped out as quickly as they did that work. So it'll be a very interesting world ahead of us in that regard. But neurological disease is a big thing. Social, cultural. The presence of family, spouse, certainly, children, next. This may be, you know, we talk about the Judeo-Christian ship already having passed through our culture. Thankfully, we're still bouncing around in the wake from time to time. And one of those factors may be that we recognize the fact that family still steps up and does these kinds of things. There are other cultures around this planet, incidentally, that are moving much farther from that, much faster than we are. I want to forewarn you about that. Keep your eyes open in certain parts of the world where the attitude about caring for parents, even if we do it begrudgingly, some places they don't do it at all. Okay? And it's an important social thing to keep our eyes on as we become, you know, so global and multicultural. Some pieces of cultures are best to not absorb in, that this might be something that we want to hang on to. But in either case, the presence of family members, spouse first and foremost, female family members is the next piece of it. So it is a relatively dangerous world for somebody who is disabled and alone. Pretty dangerous. Their likelihood of ending up in a nursing home is markedly higher than any of the rest of us. Single, alone people, no family, no spouse, no children, disabled. We go back to 1 Timothy 5. Paul went to great lengths, right? He's talking to Timothy, and he says, real widows, not real widows. First off, the girls who just lost their husband, go get them a nice, you know, singles club. Let's go meet them a guy, all right? I mean, read the text. That's pretty much what he's saying. The real widows, the ones that are really going to be dependent upon the church, they are dependent upon the church. Their ministry is to pray for all the rest of us. Our ministry is to make sure that they're going to be okay. So the single human beings, of which there are more and more if you haven't noticed, largest, you know, we have watched a rising tide of singleness in our society, the demographers tell me. That's not just because the kids aren't getting married. There's a small element of that. It's principally because older women are alone. Living alone, outliving their spouses, estranged from their family. If they are a part of the body of Christ where we are, we've got to sort through very tightly this issue with regard to, we either need to call a son or a daughter, potentially in rebuke, and say, how are you going to be a part of this with us? And I know our pastoral staff has done that here. That's a tough call. It's a tough place. Or we need to recognize, how are we as the body of Christ going to be involved? Because they're in a lot more danger of ending up in places that they didn't want to be and didn't need to be. Even with Medicaid, issues of poverty play into this. Okay. Next axiom. Every goal of elder life, independence, choice, generosity, legacy, is changed by chronic illness. Very, very briefly, I'll try to make that point for you. The psychologists tell us that as we get older, For those of you who have studied some of this stuff, Eric Erickson comes to mind, okay? That we have developmental stages that we need to go through, milestones, things that we need to achieve, tasks, developmentally, from the time that we're little babies, okay? And we make our way up. Well, the ones that come later in life, where people like me are, okay? I'm a man heading toward my mid-50s, okay? And onward. Is to learn, you know, already having dealt with issues about identity and intimacy, stable in those areas, the next place you go is what's called generativity. It's the recognition that I'm not the be-all and end-all of this thing. That I begin to love those who follow behind me even more than I love myself. Now, don't get me wrong. Some of the older adults, and maybe include your parents, haven't really achieved that very, very well. I certainly spend more than my share of time with bitter old people. But a successful adult human being is one who over time has learned to be generative. A buddy of mine who's an admissions director for one of the nicer CCRCs here in town says he has this lady he visits, obviously keeping an eye on her to make sure when she finally gets ready to sell the big old house, she's going to be coming to him. And so he comes over and visits the big old house from time to time. And he's learned over the years, don't compliment anything anymore. He used to compliment like crazy. She'd have it wrapped up, packed, and ready for him when he was walking out the door. She's letting it go. She's giving it up. She's recognizing from a biblical context, I got another home, and it's every day that goes on, it means more to me than the one that I'm in right now. I got another life, and you know what? This one, boy, I'm seeing the cracks in this one more all the time. I'm not bitter about it, but I can't wait for the next one. And that sense, I have convinced that as a young man, I did not grasp the doctrine of the imminent return of Jesus. I am just now starting to understand it, not as a concept in my head, but as a place in my heart. I want to go home. And so you meet people, wise older saints, who that's the resonance of their heart, okay? But it started early. It started at those times that you're, this may seem familiar to some of us, it certainly does to me, that you're full of education and vim and vigor and ego, young adult child, looks you in the face and tells you how the world works. And you smile and you recognize, oh, the things you don't know. Now my decision is, do I let you crash into them? Do I step out ahead of you? What's the right thing to do in this context? There's a skill of being generative, of learning to be able to put somebody ahead, okay? And it goes on. In our society right now, here's where it relates to the economics. Everybody, we go through a normal life financially as you accumulate some wealth, some finances, some assets, a different source. Then you have the period of time where trying to defend against paying too much in taxes and trying to keep up with inflation or lack thereof, so on and so forth, you try to hold that. And at some point in your late life, at one point quite suddenly, since there are no U-Hauls in the back of hearses, at some point in your life, you let go of all of it. But the idea is that you're beginning to distribute it and let go of it as a part of your generative process early on. Make gifts to grandchildren, pass on family properties, whatever it might be. Some of them are more representational of legacy in the family and meaning than they are necessarily physical, extrinsic value, but it doesn't matter. It's that process. What happens if somebody comes along and says you might be one of those people that's going to need to keep an extra $250,000 around just in case in order for you to pay for your care? Are we, in fact, in a society that just because of the odd way in which we structure this right now, we might end up being in a position where we are discouraging what would be the normal generative process of giving away, of pouring into somebody else's life, because even the rules on Medicaid say, if I give you money as my family member, 5 years better go by before I ever come back to Medicaid and ask them for their assistance. A lot can happen in my life in 5 years. I may frankly not have known 5 years before that I was going to end up in the situation that I am right now. Can you give that back to me? I think it was in your kid's tuition. I think it's the roof that's on your house. I think it was you being able to pay off your mortgage. I can't get that back now. It's a very convoluted, odd system, but that's kind of where we are right now. And I have to wonder, are we in fact discouraging some of the normal development? Because, as is often the case, money has taken on both a source of confusion, but also a source of potential fear. As I mentioned, preservation stage of finances, the biggie of all of these. We can usually deal with taxes, right? I mean, we find some nice strategies, good CPAs out there, of which I'm not one. We can often deal with inflation, market risk. It's been, as you know, very different environment in these last few years for investments. Those of you who are looking for a little bit of yield with not much risk out there, it's been a very different environment than it has in years before. People moving assets back and forth in different ways. But the biggie is the cost of the long-term care issue. So, Cindy, to your point, the overlap on financial sources on these. Medicare, you're sick, you're getting better, you're rehabbing, will pay for it irrespective of where you receive those services. That could be at home, it could be at the hospital, it's usually where it started, but they don't let you stay there for very long. It could be in a long-term care facility. Almost everything else after that point goes to private pay or a third-party payer that you obtained, insurance, unless you're poor. If you're poor, and the definition of poor, just so we can be clear, it's broader than some of you think. Medicaid's definition of poor for a single adult is that they have no more than $1,500 of assets, including any cash value inside of their life insurance policies. They have spent down to that level. Then they kick in their income, and then anything after that will be paid for, no matter how expensive it is, by the rest of us in the society. So for a single person, we're talking about devastatingly poor. We're talking about truly indigent in that regard. If they're able to live in their home, because they have a family member that lives there with them, they're actually able to keep that home. If they're able to have that family member drive their car, they're able to keep that car. So they can function in the society and receive Medicaid at home, which in our state we call passport. That's fine. We'll allow you to keep those certain assets to be able to do that. But in the end, the idea is you spent up what you had first. It's different with spouses. Spouses, we recognize, well, wait a second. If we use up all the money on one spouse and we've impoverished the other one, we just made that spouse that much more vulnerable. So we can't be ridiculously generous toward this person, but let's go ahead and acknowledge that. So what are we going to allow? We're going to allow a maximum of about $120,000 that person can hang on to in the Medicaid system. So what would that mean? That means if a couple has in excess of $240,000, they're not going to be able to maximize every dollar that they've got. Some of it's going to have to get spent on care first. But if they had $240,000 and down, which is not a small amount of money, if you take a look at where a lot of folks are, that if they had $240,000 or more down, they can't see this on the recording, but let's use my maximum amount. Okay? And so half of it goes to one spouse, half of it goes to the other spouse. So who are we going to make sick? The guy or the lady? This is a sad situation. Come on, somebody make a quick decision for me. The guy. Oh, poor gentleman, poor gentleman. All right. So he's the one that's applying. Okay? All right. So right from the beginning, I got $240,000. Excuse my scribbles. Quick, somebody who's been paying attention to this fire hydrant giving you a sip of water, how much can I move over to her? 120. Okay. What can I spend his on? Care. That's a good answer. That would be the logical one that we would think of. Is there anything else I can spend his money on? This is called spend down. Prepaid funeral. Sure, they're both going to die at some point. So we can pay for funeral times two. What else? Anything else I can spend his money on besides the care? I mean, care's good. We need to pay these people. No problem. But anything else that comes to your mind? How about, what would you think maybe her housing? That roof that she always intended to get around to? The driveway that needs to be repaved? You know what? Forget it. She shouldn't be living in that little house anyway. Let's get her a condo. Part of his money can go to her because we're concerned about her being protected. spousal impoverishment. We don't want her to be in an unstable situation. She's already got enough on her plate. That's not a forever amount of money. It's not huge. But so now we're taking that $120,000. Oh, wait a second. She has to get around too, right? She can replace that vehicle, trade it in, the one that's got a lot of miles on it, get a better one so she's more stable, she's ready on it. Any other thoughts? The tomb, absolutely. So all of the burial stuff, all taken care of. You know, it's been tough these past years. She has accumulated a little bit of debt. They took out the home equity line those years ago, and it's still sitting there. It's been such a low interest rate. They haven't messed with it for all these years. Let's pay off her debts. As you can start to see, this was funerals times two, replacing the vehicle, home improvements of any sort, maybe even the replacement of the home under the right circumstances, which incidentally could possibly be fused with family members. Let's say it is fused by family members and she needs care someday. Well, if she's getting that care from family members, or if he could in that same environment, 2 years goes by, they don't even do a look back any longer. You know, I said it's 5 years for an asset. It's not if you're a caregiver. It's two. So there's some opportunities for planning that come in here. And this is Medicaid. This is poor people. We are intentionally making him poor. But because of the spouse, as you can see, there's a lot more play in this than necessarily, and to be honest, most of the caseworkers I know are really good human beings. If you actually got the chance to talk to them before you're at the altar of the meeting with them, they would tell you this years before. But they're not out there in the community teaching anybody about it. Instead, who's out there in the community, and I say this with due respect, are other methods that could be far higher numbers than this of attorneys that will teach you how you can transfer all your assets over in a gift, make your way through a penalty period to get to the end of those 5 years, disavowing yourself of it, still having those dollars sitting out there, but held as somebody else with all the risks, incidentally, that go with the somebody else. The fact that the kid that you gave it to could get divorced, half of it's gone. Their kid could smash their car into somebody, have liability, those dollars are gone. Any of the other things that happen in normal life, okay? But there are strategies to be able to lawfully move those dollars out. This is the base. This is the plain vanilla way in which a spend down is managed without doing any other additional Medicaid estate planning. You'll notice that human being, that human being, spouses. No such arrangement exists for children. There's no spousal protections. There's no estate protection unless that child is disabled. Same logic. Why create one more vulnerable person when we didn't need to? Yes, Bill.
Are there some assets such as retirement
No, interestingly, it's a great question because you're right. Often in other kinds of governmental division of assets, like a qualified distribution at divorce or things like that, we treat those kinds of assets a little bit differently or we exclude them. No, not only do they include all the assets in here, including retirement, real property, family property, things like that, it would have to have been held outside of arm's reach. So even a living trust, because by definition, a living trust, a revocable trust, is something I can reach into if I'm the trustee, and I can grab it. If you can grab it, go grab it. They'll make you grab it before we start paying as taxpayers onto it. So there's very, very limited number of places that assets would be excluded the way that they are in some others. Sadly, the IRS is not completely online with this as well. So in other words, if you had to tap out a retirement account in one moment in time in order to be able to pay for that, right? So if all of a sudden you did all of this and you did $120,000 of transactions to make this money liquid out of that old 401k account or that IRA, you just increased your taxable income by $120,000. You just bumped yourself two tax brackets in the process. And the IRS got a lot more money in the process. That just stinks. But these are the kinds of, I just wanted to give you a quick snapshot to get an idea that to get those Medicaid benefits, and they do apply universally for nursing homes, very rare exception otherwise, an increasing number of assisted living facilities, lots of home care. This waiver program of getting more community-based and assisted living services out with Medicaid is becoming more common. That means this process is becoming more common. Yes? Yes. Yeah, that's a great question. The question just for the recording. The question is, under what circumstances, particularly under what caregiving circumstances, can children become involved in this process? And I'll say specifically with regard to Medicaid. Certainly, if that child is disabled, they can. But you're erudite in asking the question. There is also another exception for caregivers. And it's specific to one asset, and that's the family home, the house, the resident. It need not necessarily be one that the person had lived in. Could be a new residence that they came to together. But if a physician is willing to give to attest that for a period of 2 years, this person couldn't have lived in the community if it wasn't for this kid, that this person was dependent upon them. And it's not even, it needs to be supported with documentation that would go back to things like activities of daily living. But it can be wholly based on instrumental activities in some cases. It has to be a high level of disability, basically. And ultimately, a physician's statement that they'd be comfortable showing medical records to support. Now, hence we get back to showing up in the doctor's office with mom and dad, right? Building that relationship, making sure that you're known, making sure that we understand this is a care system that's taking place in this family. To have documents that say, yep, for 2 years, this older adult stayed in the community, and hence off the potential for being in a very expensive care facility. For a 2 year period of time, because of this older adult. At that point, whatever cash they still have, whatever investments they still have, they still need to continue to spend down. But that home that now that child has been living in with them now can become their home. And we wipe it off. Right now, that's up to a little bit over $500,000 of asset value that they would allow. So it could be a house of $500,000 value, a little bit more. And they'd say, OK, we're not looking at that one. You don't have to sell that house if mom needs to go to an assisted living facility or a nursing care facility.
Is it just the home or is it vehicles also that we use in this care?
No. Right now, it's just the home. And it's an interesting, quirky piece of the every time they revise the code, I'm always looking for that one first. Because it really is just, you think about it, it's just an artifact of our history that families taking care of families still has that little bit of extra, the assumption being there, okay, we're at least going to recognize families take care of families and incorporate it into our otherwise governmental system to provide for it. Shoot. Yeah, the question is raised, where do we learn more about some of these things? Well, I'm going to cover, and we've got to decide about a break, because I'm aware that there's some just a room full of bladders here. Good coffee. I want to still touch upon a little bit more of that. But in terms of in general, your best public sources to be able to get accurate information, it's a little bland, but it's accurate information, about non-customized, about these kinds of public benefits and the like, would be either your area agency on aging, which is different for your different counties. So the Western Reserve Area Agency on Aging, which is based in Cleveland, is Cuyahoga Lake, Lorain, Geauga, and Medina. Go figure. If you're in Ashtabula County, it's all the way down in the Mahoning Valley, you know, down near Youngstown. Stark Summit, I think it's based in Uniontown, or it might be in Akron. Okay. In either case, the Area Agency on Aging is a nice central repository for, particularly with a bent toward, how do we stay at home, how do we stay in family care, how do we keep this thing together, what resources are out there. And that includes some other county-based or municipal-based, in some cases, support programs that even if you're not eligible for Medicaid yet, there are some funds that they can bring in for respite services and the like that come at your county level. The Area Agency on Aging would always know about that. The Ohio Department of Aging has placed itself in the position as being the central repository for information about Medicaid. They don't actually run the Medicaid program. The Medicaid program is actually run by the Ohio Department of Jobs and Family Services. They are far less useful, to my mind, in terms of consumer-oriented information. They're undoubtedly, they're very, very careful about wanting to make sure that they don't say anything wrong, because they are responsible for enforcing those rules, okay? Now, obviously, there are a number of elder lawyers that do work in this area. There are other financial advisors like myself that do work in this area to be able to guide people to figure it out. And that's the key when it comes down to customizing. But I think you're very wise. Try to get a general sense. My own personal sense is that paying for care on your own, you can do by yourself. This kind of spend down, following the basic rules, is something that with a little bit of help, guidance on the rules from either a social worker, a financial advisor, or a lawyer, is actually something that's a semi-do-it-yourself kind of thing. Any legitimate planning, where you're trying to transfer assets, you're trying to deal with somebody with disabilities, you're trying to bring in something else quirky into this, please, 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 this is not a do-it-yourself problem. There are rules that are very obtuse. You wouldn't even know that they're there, and you can end up tripping up and quite inadvertently making a mistake. You did not intend to cheat the system, but boy, you sure don't have the documentation to prove that. And the burden of proof is actually on the applicant. It's not that you have a right to Medicaid. You're asking for a benefit in that regard. Let me move this forward a little bit. And okay, we okay without a break? No. Okay. We're going to take a 10-minute break, and I will end up collapsing down the last piece. I'll just need a minute to be able to do that, okay? If we can make 10 into 5, that'd be awesome, guys. Thank you.